Episode 10 of By Our Own Hands. We walked for a time before Sean spoke again. The tenants have already lost their grazing rights. Old man Seamus said he was going to have to kill one of the cows he owns, Sean said. We were silent for a spell. We continued walking towards the house. No one can afford to pay their rent and rescue their animals once they have been penned up by Mr. Adair, he added. I thought of the pound Mr. Adair had erected. I had only seen a few captured sheep in the pound since it was erected, except for that very morning when I had seen 3 sheep and 2 cows. I knew that one of the cows belonged to Mrs. Barry. I had heard Mrs. Barry complain. I suddenly stopped walking because it dawned on me that the sudden increase in captured livestock coincided with the arrival of the Scotsmen. This could not be a coincidence. The Scotsmen are helping Mr. Adair collect the livestock found grazing on his land, I asked. Sean nodded his head. Yes, Aoife, Mr. Adair knows that this is a great hardship on his poorest tenants. He doesn't give a damn. Do you really believe that he wants to keep those tenants? He asked. I didn't answer him. I saw the house come into view. I knew that I had to speak with Mrs. O'Donnell. I didn't want her to be angry with Sean for putting such dire thoughts into my head. I would have to be careful. Sean and I parted ways as we reached the house. I went straight to the kitchen. I was pleased to find Mrs. O'Donnell alone. She was peeling apples. She smiled at me as I approached. Her smile faded after a few moments. What is troubling you, love? She asked. I heard someone say that Mr. Adair is going to replace everyone with sheep, I said. Mrs. O'Donnell nodded thoughtfully. She walked over to the table and we sat down. Aoife, our neighbors are worried, but their worries have more to do with history than the present circumstances, she said. I waited for her to continue. These new men came from Scotland. Do you know where that is? She asked. I didn't answer. I knew that it was not far, and England was not far, but my understanding of not far was vague at best. We live on an island. There is a bigger island east of us. It is very close to us. That island is Britain. The northernmost region of Britain is Scotland. South of Scotland is England. Britain is ruled by a monarch, a king or a queen. Right now we have a queen. Britain also has a parliament. The parliament makes laws and the queen must approve them, she said. What if she doesn't want to? I asked. Then she is unhappy, Mrs. O'Donnell said. If she doesn't make laws, what does she do? I asked. Mrs. O'Donnell smiled. Different people will have different answers for that question. Our queen doesn't make laws, but she does make history, she said. I frowned because I wasn't entirely sure of the meaning of her words. The future is determined to some degree by the past. The queen represents history and tradition, while parliament represents the future and change. We need both or there will be chaos. Do you understand? She asked. I nodded, and this time I did understand. I knew that we couldn't live with only change and newness. We needed our history and traditions, but we couldn't be mired in the two. Everyone knows that history has a tendency to repeat itself, she said. Her countenance changed as she spoke these words. I didn't respond. I knew she had something important to impart to me. Many years ago, more than a century, change came to Scotland and England. The changes were devastating. England had prospered due to its many accomplishments in faraway lands. These faraway lands contributed so much to England that the wealthy among the English did not need to keep so many tenants. They enclosed their great estates and forced their tenants out. The laws that made this possible were called enclosure laws. The enclosed estates were protected by fences and horrific man traps, she said. I couldn't help myself. What is a man trap? I asked. It is a terrible device made of metal. It has thick spikes. It is set as a trap and hidden underneath leaves or in hedges. The unsuspecting person who steps on it finds himself with a metal trap clamped around his leg with steel spikes digging into his flesh, she said. I shuddered. I wished I hadn't asked. These traps were used to keep tenants from using estates for grazing. The traps killed and maimed animals and people. In time, people were forced off of their traditional lands, and they fled to towns and cities to work in dangerous factories, she said. She sighed and looked away from me. The lairds in the Highlands of Scotland decided to do the same. They called their actions improving, and they called themselves improvers. They forced tenants off of their lands with even more brutality. They replaced them with sheep. Sheep rearing is profitable, and the landlords guessed correctly that it would only become more profitable. Tenants were left to die. Some sold themselves into slavery to go to America. The passage for one adult was 7 years of freedom. People chose to sell themselves into slavery rather than die of starvation and exposure. The terror in the Highlands continued for nearly a century. Few were able to hang on and stay on their ancestral lands. These devastations are known as the evictions of the Gaels, or simply as the Highland clearances, she said. Mrs. O'Donnell, you know so much about this, I began. Mrs. O'Donnell turned to me. She smiled faintly. You are such a bright girl, she said. I was silent and waited for her to tell me what I already knew. My mother's family arrived from Scotland. They were forced off of their land. My grandmother died not long after they arrived in Ireland, she said. I thought of my father's tales, my tales. This was one of Mrs. O'Donnell's tales, one of her mother's tales. Now it was mine, too. The year of your birth was the last year of Angora Moor. Do you know what I speak of? She asked. Yes, I said. I knew very well. During those terrible years, many landlords forced their tenants off of their lands. The unfortunate people evicted from their homes were often replaced with sheep and cattle. This is when people began to fear that the evil that overtook the English and the Scottish landlords would overtake the Irish landlords, she said. We are Gaels too, I said. Yes, love, we are. Many fear that the English will not be satisfied until they have removed all of their Gaels, she said. Do you believe that? I asked. The English landlords were rich with ill-gotten gains from America and the West Indies. The Scottish landlords were too English. Our landlords are sometimes despicable and evil, but they are not rich with anything other than that which our land can provide. And they are not too English, she said. You don't believe they will treat their tenants as the English and Scottish landlords did theirs? I asked. No, I don't. History and tradition, dear. History and tradition. These two haunt the wealthy as much as they haunt the poor, she said. I don't understand, I said. During Angora Moor, many of the landlords that forced their tenants into coffin boats and replaced them with sheep and cattle suffered complete financial ruin. Much of Ireland, especially Western Ireland, is simply not suitable for large numbers of livestock and the grazing they must do, she said. Do you think that is because we have so much hungry grass? I asked. She looked at me with surprise. She pondered this and then nodded in agreement. "Perhaps, love, perhaps," she said. She sighed and placed one of her hands over one of mine. "You have probably heard that Scottish sheep will be arriving soon," she said. "Yes," I said. "It is true, they are Mr. Adair's. He will not bring over many sheep. That is why there are so few Scotsmen. If he was bringing over hundreds of sheep, he would need more shepherds. This rocky, boggy land cannot sustain large numbers of sheep. Mr. Adair will offer everyone new leases. Once he believes that he has asserted himself with his tenants, he will acquiesce to some of their wishes. Their livestock will be able to graze upon common lands again. The specter of history has rekindled old fears. It doesn't help matters that these new damnable shepherds are Scots," she said. I giggled. I wasn't used to Mrs. O'Donnell using profanity. "And our master fancies himself a Scotsman," she added. I giggled again. She smiled at me. "Will the sheep arrive tomorrow?" I asked. "Yes, tomorrow morning. Mr. Murray and Mr. Grierson are leaving tonight. They claim they will return before any of us have finished our morning meals. I'll believe that when I see it," she said. I nodded my agreement. "I have a pie to make," Mrs. O'Donnell said as she stood up. I followed her. I grabbed a bowl of peeled apples and a knife. I walked back to the table and started to slice them very thinly. Mrs. O'Donnell watched me. I could see that she was impressed. "Where did you learn to slice apples so perfectly?" she asked. "My father loved apple pie," I said. "I believe we all do, love," she said. She returned to her task of peeling apples. I sat at the table for the next hour, carefully slicing her peeled apples. I concentrated on my task and sliced away thoughts of Sean, Old Man Seamus, and Mr. Murray. I sliced all of Mrs. O'Donnell's apples and received much praise for my work. When Mrs. Barry entered the kitchen, I found a reason to excuse myself. I knew that she would want to discuss her penned-up cow, and I didn't want to hear her. The next morning, I rose early. I woke Sean. He didn't need an explanation. We both hurried to wash and dress ourselves. We quietly crept out of the back of the house. Once we were a short distance from the house, we began to run. We ran for almost a mile before we stopped. We were both breathless. "We can't go any further. We need to be able to return before we are missed. Mrs. Barry will be preparing breakfast soon," I said. "I know," Sean said, frowning. He eyed a tree that was nearby. It was tall with thick, sturdy branches. I followed his gaze. "Yes," I shouted. I began climbing the tree. When I was a few feet up, he began to climb too. "Aoife, don't climb too fast. I want to be able to catch you if you fall," he shouted. I waited for him to climb within a foot of me, and then I climbed higher. Soon I reached a thick branch and awkwardly climbed onto it. Sean followed. I looked down and felt some unease. We had climbed several feet. Our view was far and clear. We both began to look in a direction that we knew the men would come driving the sheep. I immediately saw one of the Scotsmen. It was Mr. Grierson. He was walking downhill, driving his sheep. He had no more than 2 dozen sheep with him. I wondered where the other Scotsmen were. I didn't have to wonder for long. After some moments, we saw Mr. Campbell. He had no sheep with him. I thought of Mrs. O'Donnell's words of assurance and breathed a sigh of relief. "Where are all of the sheep?" I asked. Sean didn't answer me. I looked down again and tried to measure how far I had climbed. I kicked my feet in the air. I stopped when I heard Sean inhale a sharp breath. I looked quickly in a direction of the hill. I gasped at the sight. At least 50 more sheep had come over the hill, and they were still coming. They kept coming and coming. Sean and I watched silently as no fewer than 500 sheep came over that hill. Mrs. O'Donnell, God bless her, had been wrong. I knew that Mr. Adair could keep his sheep on his lands that were not occupied by tenants, but I also knew that those sheep would beget lambs, and once they did, Mr. Adair would be in the same predicament as old man Seamus. He would have to slaughter his prized animals or rid himself of his tenantry. I am sure I have tired you, Dr. Foxlow says. No, I reply quickly, without hesitating. I am immediately embarrassed. The doctor is probably trying to politely excuse himself. I look at him and am relieved to see that this is not the case. He is genuinely pleased. I have a confession to make, he says. I am intrigued. When you speak of your family and your legacy, I am reminded of a story from my own family, he adds. I am curious and remain quiet. I want him to continue. I can see that he is somewhat embarrassed. When I was a child, my grandfather told me a tale that had been passed on for several generations in my family. It seems that his mother was descended from a man that went to Ireland at the time of Queen Mary I. This man had been married as a very young man. He had lost his wife to fever, and his children had grown and started homes of their own. He took a second wife and went to Ireland as one of the English Catholic planters of Laois. His wife died shortly after arriving due to a raid. His family never learned of his death, and to this day, we believe that he may have survived. He may have married again, and we might have relations in Ireland, he concluded. What was his name? I ask. Samson, he says. He glances at me, and I see the expression on his face suddenly change. I know it is because the expression on mine has suddenly changed, and he is trying to read my reaction. I am astonished. He is now very embarrassed and somewhat perplexed. Have I offended you? It was just a story, he says, his voice trailing off. I am not offended, but I am very surprised. Your story is true. I know for a fact that it is true, I say. He looks at me with surprise and some relief. How do you know for certain that my story is true? He asks. I take a deep breath and tell my tale, my father's tale, and his father's tale. Isabella had stood before a looking glass with a candle in hand as she had chanted her incantation, Bloody Mary, show me my intended. Her intended had not appeared, but years later he called on her and she became his bride. She bore him three daughters, Isabella, Maud, and Eva, who was named for her own mother, Aoife. Aoife had been water. She had lived and breathed. Isabella was drawn to the life and breath of her mother. She was drawn to the sea. One day, Isabella stood at the shore with her daughters. She watched as the water crashed upon the rocky shore and then receded back to the sea. Grace and violence, a miracle and a tragedy, life and death. An old woman approached them. Isabella saw that it was the same old woman who had appeared to her so many years before. The old woman took the youngest of the girls by the hand and walked towards the shore. Isabella followed with the other two. They stopped close to the sea, far too close. It beckoned as it threatened them. The old woman bent down and began arranging small stones into three long rows, each consisting of many stones. She finished her task and began to speak. Your daughters will complete the holy cycle. They will not be stripped of life and death. They will be settled stones, but each will beget life and death, she said. The waves came rushing in and washed over the stones. The waters rushed between and around the stones. The stones did not move. Isabella watched as the old woman bent over the stones. She touched the first of the stones in the first row. She glanced at Isabella's daughter, also named Isabella. 12 stones from Isabella, a bloody tyrant with a crown, she said. She touched the first of the stones in the second row. 11 stones from Maud, a queen for him who will bear him a queen, she said. She tapped the same stone again. 12 stones from Maud, a queen for him who will bear him a queen, she said. She touched the first stone in the third row. 12 stones from Ava, a sister to the queens born by his queens. Her prince will be a demon, she said. Your mother's land will drown in blood and tears if the demon is not overcome. Fire must overcome the demon, or her land will be forsaken. Do not fail to heed these words, for the time will come. The waves rushed in again. The old woman walked away. Her words came to pass more than 3 centuries later, at the time of Dermod Dorian. When Dermod stirred in his mother's womb, she had a terrible dream. She dreamt of a young, red-haired man who battled flames that threatened to engulf him. She watched as he was burned. She watched as he reached into the flames and drew out a sword. She could not help him. She could only stand by and watch. She woke from this dream in a terrible state. An old woman sat at her bedside, awaiting the labor pains she knew would soon come. She soothed and consoled Dermod's mother. The old woman told her that the young red-haired man in her dream was not her son. That is why she could not assist him. He was fire, and he was forged in fire, just like his sword. He was burned, but he was not overcome. Her son would not have to be fire. He would be burned too, but he would not have to overcome fire. He would have to assist another, the one who was forged in fire. She told her that her son would be brave and strong, but he would have to be a warrior who did not strive for his own glory, but for that of another. He would have to be loyal. The old woman cautioned that only one vice could undo him, and that was envy. When he was born, he was named Dermod, which means without envy, in the hope that he would be loyal when he was called upon to help the one who was forged in fire. Dermod was his father's heir. He was the prince of his name by his 20th year. His father taught him well and guided him. But he was not his king. His king was the chief of the Omors, Rory O'More. He had been his father's king, too. He was the hope of Leash. Dermod and his father knew that Rory was the one that had been forged in fire. The year of Dermod's birth had been an ominous one for Leash. The English had built a new fort near Dermod's home. It was called Fort Protector. The establishment of the English fort was followed by a law that forbade any O'More from possessing land. A stroke of a pen destroyed the legacy of the most powerful family in Leash. The bloody tyrant responsible for this law was Henry Tudor, the King of England. Henry had hoped that he could dispossess the Gaels of Leash and plant English settlers onto their lands. Leash bordered the only country that was firmly within English hands, the English Pale, which stretched from Dundalk to Dublin and reached as far inland as Kells and Trim. This small region bordered Leash. The inhabitants of the English Pale, the Old English, had often raided and pillaged the lands of their Gaelic neighbors. The Gaels would then retaliate and raid the Old English. This had been the case since the days of Strongbow and Princess Aoife. Henry believed that he could rid himself of the Gaels of Leash, and in doing so, rid himself of the greatest threat to the English Pale. He was mistaken. Rory O'More rose up in opposition. He was supported by the other chiefs of Leash. His greatest supporter was Dermod's father. The clans of Leash drew support from the clans of Offaly, who also had been threatened repeatedly by the English. An alliance was formed. Henry threatened to send his armies. Before he could do so, he suddenly died. All of Leash and Offaly breathed a sigh of relief. Years passed by, and Henry's daughter Mary claimed the throne of the English. She was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. She married her Spanish cousin Philip. Mary and Philip made a terrible choice. They approved a law to shire Leash and Offaly. It was decreed that each were to become counties and their lands were to be offered to English planters. Leash was to become Queen's County in honor of the queen born by a queen. Offaly was to become King's County in honor of her husband, Philip. She sent an army. She also sent a Lord Protector. He was Sir Henry Sidney. He brought with him his wife, Mary Dudley, who was like a sister to the queen born by a queen. On the day that the soldiers arrived, the rains fell relentlessly. Dermod emerged from his home to find that the end of his humble home was on fire. The relentless rains did little to impede the flames, and the wind seemed to empower them. He looked about the flat landscape of Leash and saw that the other homes were ablaze. That is when he saw the soldiers. It was they who had set the homes ablaze. Dermod held little land and could not afford an army. He was the only warrior he could offer to his king. He grabbed his sword and ran towards the land of the O'Mores. He ran until his lungs burned and his clothes were soaked through. He finally reached the court of Rory O'More. He fell before him, panting and choking. He told him what he had seen. Within an hour, the great chief had called his army to his court. He told them that they would set out at dawn and they would fight for their rightful lands. Dermod was instructed to travel to the courts of the nearest clans, the O'Devoys, McEvoys, and O'Kellys. He was to tell them to meet at an appointed time and place. Separate messengers were sent to the O'Dallines and the O'Lalors. Dermod was given a horse and he began his journey. He rode all night and encountered one devastation after another. He learned that the English armies had surprised the O'Dempseys and O'Connors of Offaly before invading Leash. They had slaughtered many of the O'Devoys, though Kellys had suffered a similar fate. Messengers sent to O'More had been cut down before they could reach the great chief. The English soldiers were as locusts on the land, devouring what they did not destroy. The armies of the great chiefs were outnumbered and forced to fight the English in several parts of their country while trying to protect their own people. The English took vast parts of Leash. They established a large protected area near the English fort of Maryborough, where no Gael was to be found. On these lands, they planted the new English of Leash. Dermod later watched them arrive with their families and livestock. They were Queen Mary's English, but soon the queen, born by a queen, was no more. She was succeeded by a new queen, her sister. This new queen, Elizabeth, was also born by a queen. She too believed that the destruction of Gaelic Leash and Offaly would bring peace to the Irish lands held firmly by the English. The Gaels of Leash raided the settlements of the New English. At times, all of the New English were walled up in Maryborough, too terrified to leave their fort. At other times, they boldly raided the lands of the Gaels. Elizabeth learned from Henry Sidney that one of the old English of the English Pale had offered his services. He was a young man who had learned the language of the Gaels. He claimed that he could make the Gaels put down their swords. His name was Francis Cosby. Henry Sidney and his wife, Mary Dudley, traveled to Dublin. They met Francis Cosby. He did not ask for an army, but instead believed that he could make terms with the Gaels. Sidney did not wish to make terms, but he still authorized Francis's request to try. Francis's ancestors had arrived in English Pale shortly after Strongbow. His family had known raids, and he had carried out raids. He knew that if terms were not made with the Gaels of Leash, it would be the same for the New English. Francis did not trust Sidney, but he did trust his wife, Mary Dudley. He knew that she was like a sister to his queen, and she would be willing to plead his case if Sidney refused to do so. If Sidney offered terms of peace and failed to keep them, Mary Dudley would inform the queen.